Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. This week, I'm thrilled to welcome back Jason Bailey, who's a film critic, historian, and author of the new book on James Gandolfini entitled Gandolfini, Jim, Tony, and the Life of a Legend. He's also the author of five previous books, including Richard Pryor, American Id, and Fun City Cinema, New York City, and the Movies That Made It. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Vanity Fair, Vulture, Bloomberg, Rolling Stone, Time, Slate, and more. Jason lives in the Bronx with his wife and two daughters. Well, Jason, I had the best time talking to you at Poison Pen, so this is a real treat having you back. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm okay. I'm tired. The book has been out now for, as we're recording this, for 2 weeks and 2 days. And it feels like I've said every single thing that can be said about this man and his work, but hopefully today I'll prove myself wrong, I hope. For the sake of you and your listeners, but yeah, it's been a lot. It's been, you know, certainly the most exhaustive promo tour I've done for a book. But I it seems to be paying off. I hope it's paying off. People seem to be buying the book and reading it and enjoying it. So fingers crossed.
Yes, I have been so excited to see all of the raves you're getting in the press and people on social media just loving it. So for those listening, do pick up Gandolfini, Jim, Tony, and the Life of a Legend by Jason Bailey. I loved this biography. I'm not just saying that because Jason is a friend. It's a fabulous book. Yes, it is so
a
good.
Great Father's Day gift.
It really
Father's
is.
Day is will be here before you know it. And that's a one click Father's Day shopping done. Find me a dad who doesn't like Gandolfini and I won't believe that they exist.
Yeah, who doesn't like James Gandolfini? I mean, it was a good Mother's Day gift, and now it's a good Father's Day gift. Everybody
Correct.
Wins.
Correct.
Yes.
Good Arbor Day gift. Good. Good Halloween gift. I'll keep pushing it.
Yes. Well, the good thing about today and how my show works, and people who listen know, for good and bad, that we can just go on tangents. So we are talking about Gandolfini movies, but there's a lot going on in these movies. I can't wait to talk about like Andy Garcia freakouts on film because that's my favorite. We have so much to cover, Jason. So I was really thrilled that you chose the movies that you did. These aren't maybe like the greatest hits of Gandolfini's career. These are underrated performances. Oh, before we dive into the films one by one, what was it about this collection of movies that you thought really, you know, deserved some time?
I mean, you know, a question I've been asked a lot on the promo tour was like for, you know, if you had to recommend one movie for, you know, to someone who wanted to see more of the work. And I sort of had my go-to answer for that, which is Enough Said.
Yes.
We did a sort of a resurrecting bonus episode of A Very Good Year called A Very Good Gandolfini, where, and on that one, if you'd like to listen to that as well, those were the five, because it's on a pick five format as well, where I picked what I really think are his five best film performances. But when I made that list, I knew I was doing your show, and so I took pains to make them separate lists, because what I wanted to do here is really part and parcel for what I wanted to accomplish in the book, which is Tony Soprano looms so large.
Yes.
Over both American culture and, you know, the history of cable television and all of those sort of giant topics, but also over his entire career. Like, that's the role where most people who know his name first knew him. That was the role he played the longest. That was his most sort of commercially and critically successful project. Like, to a lot of people, that's sort of the James Gandolfini performance.
Yeah.
And understandably so. It's brilliant. And it's, you know, he did it for nearly a decade. It's 86 hours of television. But one of the things that I really wanted to accomplish in the book was to sort of reclaim the idea that he was a brilliant, prolific, and above all, versatile actor. you know, that he played this type of character so well and so convincingly and did it on enough other occasions that I think a lot of people sort of think that that's all he had in the tank. Yeah. And if you watch the films, especially the way that I did, you know, sort of chronologically, and with the show interspersed. So I was like watching the movies. I would watch a season of the show and then I would watch the movies that he made during that season's hiatus. And, you know, I always do that when I'm writing a book because I want to get a sense of the overall arc of the evolution of the craft or the genre or whatever we're talking about. And if you watch all of these other films, especially some of the kind of deep cuts that we're going to get into now, you see an actor who had many, many, many notes in his in his arsenal. I just mixed metaphors there. But an actor who could do a lot of different things. And so that was really what I wanted to achieve on this list, was just to show, you know, number one, the different kinds of performances he was capable of, and then also hopefully shine the spotlight on some movies that have a lot of these have kind of been forgotten as the years have passed. And so, you know, if I can accomplish both of those things at once, all the better.
Yes. No, I thought this was a really good way to appreciate his range. When I was reading the book, all of a sudden I was starting to think, oh yeah, that was him. And it did make me want to go back and watch these. Some of the films you chose, I hadn't seen, you know, in decades. Same. So it was really cool to kind of dive back in, starting with, Night Falls on Manhattan, which I revisited the other day. I mean, it's a great Lumet film. But I think what's so cool about this one is it really weaponizes his charm. You know, you want to, like, he gets under your skin and you remember that. Mm-hmm. Like, I do remember vaguely when I was reading your book, I was like, oh yeah, I remember Mr. Wonderful. And I think I vaguely remember him in that, you know, from the 90s. But watching Night Falls on Manhattan, it had been so long. I remembered a couple of the, you know, big things in the film, but there's just something about this character. Of course, the fate of the character, it's going to stay with you and what happens, but he is so good that you can't watch this movie and not think of that performance. So I did like, and I wanted to thank you for choosing that one. Yeah.
This one is actually one that's weirdly personal to me, and for non-Gandolfini reasons, which is that I saw it when it was released. I saw it in the theater in what would have been early 1997. So I'm like 21 at the time. So this is the pocket of my life in which I really am seeing like pretty much any new release theatrically that didn't just look outright bad. You know, like that was kind of all I was doing with my free time, was going to the movies. But at the time that I saw this, I really was not well versed in Lumet. I'm sure I had seen Dog Day Afternoon because I'd gotten heavy into Pacino a few years earlier, and probably had seen Serpico. That might have been it. So there was this whole sort of world of, you know, the Lumet police corruption drama.
Yeah.
That this one sort of opened up for me. And I really went on a Lumet tear after seeing this movie that you would think I would have gone on after seeing Dog Day Afternoon or Serpico or one of the better known titles, but just sort of because of when it came out, how hard it hit me, and then finding out that this was, you know, a strain of films that he had made, that this is, first of all, kind of his last traditional Lumet thriller. One of, if not his very last screenwriting credits. And that this is like sort of all in of a piece. You have Serpico in 73, Prince of the City in 81.
Yes.
Q&A in 1990. Mm-hmm. And then Night Falls on Manhattan in 1997. So he would do one of these like every about 7 years, 8 years, he would sort of get the itch to return to this topic, which you would think would sort of run out of gas by film four.
Yeah.
But corruption in New York City government and in the NYPD and in the district attorney's office, it turns out, is just a topic that offers endless riches.
Always changing.
A theme that's not going anywhere, you know. So I've always held real affection for this movie for being a real Lumette entry point for me. But yes, at the time that I saw it also, I was like, oh, there's that James Gandolfini guy again, you know, who,
yeah,
as we discussed, you know, in our, when we talked for The Poison Pen, was someone I had been clocking since True Romance, basically.
Yes.
He makes such a strong impression in that film, and I was so taken by his work in that film, and I saw that film so many times,
mm-hmm,
because I was working in a video store when it came out.
Yes.
owned it, previewed on VHS and in every subsequent format, that I really was just like watching out for him. And when he would pop up in this was very, I also liked and wanted to pick this movie, for you, because it's also really exemplary of what his career was in the 90s. Like,
yes,
this, he was a top tier character actor who,
yeah,
usually did this, who would play, you know, he'd be like fourth or fifth billed after the title. It would be a strong supporting character, but definitely a supporting character. He would come in for a handful of scenes and just really crush it,
mm-hmm,
and usually die. Like, I
yes,
meant to go back. I found, I'm looking at my original notes from when I watched this, when I rewatched it for the book, and I made a note, which I didn't ever get around to doing, was should do an actual count. How many movies does he die in pre-Sopranos? Like, almost all of them, it seems,
yes,
like. You know, he doesn't die in Get Shorty. He doesn't die in Crimson Tide, but a whole lot of the other ones, you know, and he has a really harrowing and memorable death scene, suicide scene, trigger,
yeah,
warning, in this one. It's really heartbreaking, even though by that time you're fully aware of how dirty he is, that he is like,
yes,
not a good guy.
Yeah.
Which, again, that was, you know, at risk of sort of stating the obvious, that was one of his biggest gifts, was the gift of playing disreputable, unlikable, even monstrous characters, but playing them with a degree of sympathy and empathy that made you like them in spite of who they were. And that really is like the skeleton key to the success of Tony Soprano. But he had that in place from the beginning of the career, I think.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you mentioned this, because this was also around the time I was seeing every movie. 96, I worked in a theater for a little bit.
Oh, like, there you go. Yeah.
And yeah, I do remember I had seen a bunch of Lumet, because I remember like Murder on the Orient Express and 12 Angry Men and stuff. But I think, like you, I didn't put together, oh, this is,
right,
the guy that also did Dog Day, or this is the guy,
right,
that also. I remember seeing like Q&A. I was renting every movie. That one completely went over my head. That's a bizarre movie. But then, but this one I do remember thinking was very powerful. And so it's good to go back and watch it. It kind of has that Prince of the City thing where you sort of, you have to suspend disbelief just a little bit. You're like, wait a minute, this guy was here now. And, you know, like he, mm-hmm, kind of do not pass go or whatever, go directly to the DA's office, essentially. But,
right,
but yeah, it's a really great, film, wonderful ensemble cast. It was interesting watching this. I was noticing how many movies that Andy Garcia freaks out in.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you go from like Untouchables with the Irish thing, the Italian stuff, and then you've got, Black Rain, I love. You got Internal Affairs where he's bouncing,
yeah,
a computer chair, like in the, it's just a whole thing. And, Joey Zaza. Yes. So,
mm-hmm,
Godfather 3. So I was noticing, and even in Keeping the Faith, which I don't know if you remember that movie, there's a scene where Ben Stiller is on a date and in the theater and he doesn't want the women of his congregation to know he's out with a Gentile. And they're watching When Harry Met, or not When Harry Met Sally, When a Man Loves a Woman. And you hear Andy Garcia on screen freaking out about paper towels. And it's like, you know, there's just something about Andy Garcia freaking out. And so this is, if you're of that mindset, you enjoy a good, you know, over the top, I'm going to chew all the scenery performance by Andy Garcia, because who doesn't? This is a good movie for that. But it's also just a great film. Gandolfini, I agree with you. He's got this like mischievous thing where, you know, you don't want to believe he's dirty. And so he's like, no, it wasn't me. It wasn't your dad. Like, hey, like you almost expect him to, you know, shoulder bump or, you know, like, hey, we're fine. Let's go fishing or something. And so he's kind of like those guys you grew up with. There were a lot of cops in my family. So I'm like, I know those guys. And so yes, his arc is really good here, and it's a wonderful performance that shows a lot of range in a small amount of screen time.
Yeah, I think if you want to see just like a really exemplary piece of screen acting by everyone involved, the scene, 2/3 of the way, if not later than that in the film, that's just that dinner scene between
Oh my gosh,
Garcia,
yes.
Ian Holm, who plays his dad, and Gandolfini, who's his dad's partner, who's, they're both cops. And where basically like Garcia has to confront them with everything that he knows and fears to be true about their conduct. And the way that all three of them play that, and the way they bounce off of each other, the way they use defensive tactics and aggressive tactics as characters and actors, I think is really fascinating. The way that he's sort of, that Gandolfini is sort of folksy when he finally starts to admit it, where he kind of chuckles and says, got
Caught
caught
in
with
the
my
cookie.
hand in the cookie jar. That's right. And like escalates it from there, but then knows when to back off and uses one of my favorite tools of his, of that he has as an actor. And he uses it in Crimson Tide. It's starting to be there in True Romance. He definitely uses it in The Sopranos, which is the sort of inappropriate, menacing smirk. That look that says, I could do something and I'm choosing not to, and I'm laughing about how lucky you are for it. You know what I mean? Like, it's such a good tool that you can really only pull off if you have the sort of aggressive physical possibilities that he does. Like, a little dude can't do that. Tom Cruise can't do that, as we saw in like
No, in
Jack Reacher
Reacher,
or whatever. But Gandolfini can and does and knows when to use it and does not overuse it. I think that's the only point in the movie that he pulls that one out of the deck. But it's the right moment to do it.
I'm glad you went there because it's like you wouldn't need Gandolfini to say, I'm gonna drink your blood from a boot, because he just does that little laugh and you're like, or that gives that look and you're like, this dude could drink your blood from a boot. But
Absolutely.
what I love about that scene, and that's the one I kind of zeroed in on too, is you see a lot of different notes he's playing there. And then when they take, you know, after dinner, it's kind of like everybody's been there, you know, do I carry the dishes in? And it's getting weird. And then they go into the family room. And finally, he's just like, I don't want to come between these guys. And so then he kind of like takes it down, like, this is your son, this is your father. And you sort of know maybe where it's going to go and it's going to be sad. But I did like that yes, he's like, you know, you're lucky. I could go off on you. But also, this is my partner, the most important person to me. And then, hey, this is your son. You can't choose between us. And I did like that.
One other thing I did want to point out about this one before we move on is, Sopranos fans, you will see Dominic Chianese as the judge. That's a pretty well played, pretty prominent role. Hard to miss him. And I did find a great quote from him about sort of the first read through they did, because Lumet famously always rehearsed his movies like plays. It was a big, writes about it in that great book, Making Movies.
I
But
love that
also,
that book.
yeah, but also Vinny Pastore, aka Big Pussy, shows up clearly just like a day player as a cop without a character name or anything. But if you're looking for Big Pussy, you'll find him in there.
That's a good one. Civil Action is a movie I saw in the theater. I remember really liking it. I was one of those nerds who saw it because, oh my God, Steven Zaillian wrote it. I mean, I loved
Right.
the
No, me
cast
too.
members, but I was like, wow, this is going to be amazing. So.
I was a searching for Bobby Fischer evangelical.
Oh
Like
my
that
gosh.
was my favorite movie of 1993.
I
Like,
loved
and
it.
93 is not a punk year. 93, like,
Yeah.
Jurassic Park is out in 93. Philadelphia is out in 93. I believe Zaillian penned Schindler's List is out in 93.
Yes.
But Searching for Bobby Fischer was the movie that moved me the most that year. And I revisit it every few years, and it has lost none of its punch. It is terrific.
I know it was huge, and I remember, that movie, and then also seeing The Mammoth. I was running around like at 12, going, "You know who's good? Joe Mantegna." So, yes, so I do love that. Yeah, Civil Action is great. It reteams Gandolfini with John Travolta from Get Shorty. Gandolfini has a very small role in this movie, but it's an important one. Yeah, I had not seen this probably decades. I think I saw it maybe once on video or DVD, I should say. Actually, I don't know which was which back then, but it had been a long time. It's good. If you like Dark Water and those kind of movies, if you're younger and you've never heard of this, see Civil Action for sure.
I was talking to a friend about this one recently, and we were trying to sort of puzzle out. It feels like it has been sort of weirdly memory holed
Yeah.
for a movie with like this many sort of high caliber people involved on
Oh
both
my
sides of
God,
the
I
camera,
know.
just like the sort of the supporting characters that pop up in this one are sort of staggering. What I think may have happened was I remember that when this came out, it was very much one of those this had Oscar buzz sort of
Yes,
things.
it
Like
did.
it had a Christmas Day limited release. Like it was on the
Yes.
calendar, like a movie that they had awards hopes for. And the reviews were respectful, but like not quite enthusiastic enough for that sort of push. And I feel
Yeah.
like a lot of times when movies have that air about them, like they disappointed the awards hopes, that sort of translates somehow into a perception of poor quality. And then it also had the misfortune of coming out in theaters about a year and a half before Erin Brockovich, which gets into extremely similar territory. It's the same
Yeah,
kind of movie. It's based on a true
exactly.
story. It's, bad stuff in the water, killing kids.
Yeah.
It's, a sort of a corporate malfeasance, legal expose sort of thing. And I think that movie was so popular
Yes.
and did win awards that it sort of usurped whatever residual heat was left from this one. But when I rewatched it, also for the first time for the book, and I looked at it again last night, I was really struck by the fact that it's just a really different kind of movie, than that one. And I love Erin Brockovich and I love
Oh,
Steven
yeah.
Soderbergh. So this is not, a slam to put them up against each other. What I like about this movie is two things. Number one, it's a much more cynical movie
Oh, my
than
gosh,
Erin
yes.
Brockovich. The cynicism of the Travolta character, because it's ultimately a redemption arc, which won't, I don't think is giving anything away. But he, at the beginning of this thing, is such a slicky boy, ambulance
Oh my
chaser,
gosh.
only about the numbers. I mean, that opening monologue where he's
So
literally
cool.
breaking down how much each kind of plaintiff is worth financially.
And using
Like,
the guy in the courtroom as a prop, like, are you okay? And touching him and like doing the water, which was a nice motif
crazy.
because water comes throughout the whole film. But yeah, it's great.
And so that aspect of it, I think, is different and unique and interesting.
Yeah.
And then also what I really like about it, on rewatch is the whole strand of the William H. Macy character.
Yes.
William H. Macy plays the character, it's a small sort of boutique personal injury law firm, and Macy is in charge of the finances of the place. And this movie gets deep down into how into the incredible cost of mounting this sort of a case, and how for a lawyer like this, they have to front all of that cost because
they all had a mortgage.
Any eventual, payment that they are going to get is, a handsome cut of the settlement. Yes. Aaron Brockovich gets into that piece of it a little more. So if you've seen that, you understand what I mean. But like there, the stuff that's in this movie about the steps they have to take in order to keep the machine going, to keep feeding money into the case before it will pay off, feels to me like the kind of stuff that in a more traditional, straightforward nonfiction book adaptation would be like the first thing that would get cut out. Like that, because that's interesting on the page, but that's not dramatic. That's, you know, that's hard to stage in a sort of visually compelling way, so forth. And yet I found that to be some of the most fascinating material in the picture was that stuff.
Agreed. Yeah, the David and Goliath of it all. And I think another reason this movie kind of fell through the cracks of memory is because the 90s, we had a lot of these courtroom films. I did a whole episode with Bill Gates.
Oh, yeah. The Grisham era.
Yeah, this was the Grisham era. Even some of the reviews, like when I was looking this up contemporaneously, like Ebert was calling it like a grown-up Grisham movie. And this was around the time, one of my favorite, and I know he, you know, picks on himself for doing it, but I actually think it's one of the best Grisham movies, was Coppola's The Rainmaker.
Which it's great.
I love that film about great benefit. I still remember the insurance company. It's very ironically named. But, you know, it was a message movie. I mean, even Pelican Brief has environmental, things, but also it has the paranoid conspiracy thriller aspects. But I think, so this was kind of that. I remember Janet Maslin said something like, it airs on the side of angels. So I think seeing it on the other side of these like more palatable, popcorn ready courtroom movies maybe did impact it. It's a heavier film for sure because of those things you're mentioning. Like, you know, it's in Aaron Brockovich, you get that it's hurting Albert Finney and like to do all of this stuff, all the toll it's taking on her lives and her relationships and stuff like that. But this really gets into the granular. It also gets into just how petty and how much ego is involved in this, like the scene in the Harvard Club and the way they interact with each other, which again, I think, like you said, would be cut out of a lot of movies like this.
No, the snobbery element is extremely interesting. But let's do before we move on, let's talk about Gandolfini's role in this, which is very, very small,
but good.
Was from when I spoke to his managers, this was one of the roles he was proudest of.
Oh, good.
It was very important by this point in the career, and I've talked about this, it's in the book, and I've talked about it probably too much in interviews, but by this point in his career, he had sworn off. He told his managers and agents, don't put me up for any more mobsters or thugs. I don't want to play any more of them. And like, they had to talk him into reading for Tony Soprano because number one, he didn't want to do television. And number two, he didn't want to play any more gangsters. And this was both. But, by this point, he had walked away from that. And the reason he gave for it, was that he was the son of Italian immigrants.
Yeah.
He disliked those stereotypes.
Yep.
He didn't want to perpetuate them. He said, you know, my parents were salt of the earth people. They were working class people. And I want to play people like that and make them proud. I want to play Italian American doctors, lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. And what he loved about this role and why he took a role of this size, which frankly is smaller than he was really doing at that point in his career.
Yeah.
You know, he's in like three scenes in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And gone by the 30-minute mark, maybe.
Yep.
But he was so thrilled that he got to play, in his words, a working class hero. Yep. That Al Love was a real guy who stood up, who did the right thing, consequences be damned. He said, I got to meet this guy. I got to spend time with him and his family. And it was my pleasure to play him. And that's, and even though it's a small role, he packs so much punch. Like, the movie doesn't happen without the actions of that character. And that it's not non-dialogue, but it's just chitter chatter. The scene
again,
at the dinner table.
The first three movies I'm talking about.
Guy does some good acting at dinner tables, man.
Yes.
You know, Al Love is a father of eight.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, and there's a scene where he's trying to decide whether he's going to do the right thing, whether he's going to be a whistleblower.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sitting at the dinner table, clearly deep in thought, and watching his children pouring water, drinking water, goofing around, having a good time, looking at his kids with so much love and so much fear. And he conveys all of that without a word of dialogue, just in the expression on his face, the sadness in his eyes, which is, this is a refrain in the book, was one of his maybe his greatest tool, mm-hmm. were his eyes. And the way his physical, like the way he's sort of crossing his hands and sort of fidgeting in his chair, it's just, it's a really masterful piece of nonverbal acting. The best dialogue scene is him and Kathleen Quinlan at that picnic table.
Yes.
But the best nonverbal acting is that dinner table scene. It's really, mm-hmm. it's a wonderful performance. And, he kept working with Steve Zaillian. Like, this is one thing that really struck me about him when I went through the whole career is you see, he keep like the directors who got him knew how good he was and tried to keep working with him. You know, he did four movies with Tony Scott. He did, you know, the Coen brothers wanted him to play Bad Santa. Like, they had that script written for him. And this Steve Zaillian, they did this together. They got along famously. Zaillian casts him in All the King's Men a few years later. And then his last sort of unfinished project was Zaillian did the HBO limited series that became The Night Of. And Jim was supposed to play the role that Turturro ended up playing in that, and actually played that role in the pilot episode.
Wow.
They reshot those scenes when the show was picked up after he passed, with Turturro in the role. So, like, this was, you know, this was someone who got what was good about him and wanted to keep using him, which I think, you know, really speaks to him as an actor and a person.
Yeah, and I think what's great about, especially the scene that touched us so much, the mostly non-dialogue scene, is having done Get Shorty with John Travolta, I don't know, I mean, he could have done this scene before that, but mm-hmm. the important thing, as you wrote about in your book with Get Shorty, is noticing, at first he thought John Travolta wasn't doing anything when the camera was on him or how he was reacting. And then when he was in an actual scene with them, realizing how much he's doing with, like, so little. And so you think he could have played that scene and he could have done a great job, but maybe not to that level without having done Get Shorty, worked with John Travolta, and seen what you could do with reaction. Yeah.
That's a really good point. That's a really good connection. Yeah. Travolta really opened up for him, because by the time they're doing Get Shorty together and they've got that great scene in the parking garage where they're talking about the movies that Gandolfini's character Bear had stunted on, you know, by that point, Travolta's been doing movies for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, Jim's been doing them for three.
Yes.
And that moment of sort of understanding how little you can do for a camera, how much the camera is going to pick up, and seeing that in action from a really terrific screen actor and movie star, and Travolta was both.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. I think really, really was a key sort of moment in his education and how to do that. Yeah, that's a really good point. Travolta, again, we should mention, this is his second movie with Travolta, also of four. Like, they became good friends when they were working on Get Shorty. He's in this. They did a movie that not a lot of people have seen, but is worth seeing, called Lonely Hearts.
Oh,
which
is
basically The Honeymoon Killers, but remade and with the police perspective as a counterpoint in it. And then both are in the Pelham 123 remake, although I don't think they share any scenes.
Yeah. And then you mentioned the Coen brothers, and that brings us to, is that our next one chronologically, The Man Who Wasn't There, another film I saw in the theater, of course, because I'm from Minnesota originally. We saw all the Coen brother
Of
movies.
course.
Yes, right away. This film, I don't think I'd seen the James M. Cain pictures, and I don't know that I fully got it. I don't think I'd read Sartre, and I don't know that I really got what they were doing with this movie, so it kind of grew on me over the years. But it's one of the best looking ones for Roger Deakins, of course. It's a dark, dark movie, very nihilistic, but you need that charm that buoys it, and that's Gandolfini. Also, Frances McDormand. There's something about watching Fran laugh in these movies, and so the two of them together are just fun to watch.
I love this movie as sort of a blank check movie for them, because when you look at it in their filmography, this was the movie they made right after Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which I think is easy to forget was a huge hit,
Smash.
commercial hit, like in a way that we don't typically think of Coen Brothers movies as being, but certainly their biggest commercial success to date, and maybe period. Like, I don't think they had a bigger one after that. I could be forgetting something obvious. But that movie was gigantic. Got it was really well marketed by Touchstone, had that huge soundtrack album that ended up really buoying the movie
Song
and
on the
vice versa.
radio, crazy.
It was nuts. So, given that sort of, I love that they understand the industry well enough to know that, like, okay, well, if there's ever a moment where they're going to hand us X million dollars to make a black and white movie, commercial death, that is, film noir influenced, but has all of these other sort of, and really sort of, and I don't say this in a negative way, sort of ambiguous and unsatisfying elements to
Oh
it.
my
Like, in terms
gosh,
of
I
it
know.
just doesn't pay off in the ways that you
Not at all.
expect a movie to pay off, and, does all of these sort of unconventional things that they knew that, like, this was the moment where they could do that, and that was probably the first and last time they would have been able to do that. With this one for Jim, I got one of my favorite sort of pieces of intel from his managers with regards to this one, because he made this during the same hiatus that he made The Mexican. Which I think is also, like, a wonderful performance.
I remember really liking it, but I haven't seen it since the theater.
I mean, and what he's doing in that is a great example of what he did,
Yes, gay
what he
hitman.
did, yes, what he would do when he would occasionally play a criminal or a thug type character after Tony Soprano. He said, "I don't want to repeat myself. I don't want to keep doing Tony Soprano. I don't want to get stuck in that box." So when he would only play Tony Soprano type characters if there was an interesting way to sort of turn it on its head. And in The Mexican, it's finding out halfway through that movie that this character that has very much carried himself and sounds like and looks like Tony Soprano is gay. And, like, and is not in any way sort of swishy stereotypical about it. Another good example of that is Killing Them Softly, where, he comes on and you think he's this sort of, like, legendary hitman, and then it turns out that he's this, like, sad sack who can't do the job anymore, who's just a sort of pathetic heap of a dude who is Tony Soprano via Willy Loman. But what he's doing that in The Mexican. And he did that. That was a big studio movie with big movie stars. It's a major role, and he got a nice big payday for it. And what he told his managers when this offer came was, that he didn't even need to read the script. Whatever the Coen brothers wanted, he wanted to do. But he said he sort of saw it like a sort of a one for them being his agents, one for me. Like, I'll do this big studio picture for the big payday if I can also do this, like, scale plus 10 black and white indie thing for the Coen brothers. Like, that was kind of the trade-off that he made. And that was, I think, really smart, because this is sort of him continuing to remind moviegoers and directors and casting directors, hey, I'm still a character actor at heart. I still want to do this sort of small, interesting character role if it's in a worthy project with a director I want to work with. And that was very much sort of a lane he continued on through the rest of the career. was, you know, there's a pretty direct line from this to something like Zero Dark Thirty, you know? Mm-hmm. That's not a leading role. It's not a glamorous role, but it's an important supporting role in a project he really wanted to do yep. with a director he really respected. And that, I think, is very much what he's doing here as well.
Yeah, it's put him at the dinner table. He's going to charm, but also, so it's kind of like a Night Falls on Manhattan situation where
yeah.
he's shady. Yes.
Yeah,
And he plays so well against, Billy Bob Thornton, who mm-hmm. just is somebody under, who can also like, weaponize
redefining,
charm.
Yes, yeah. but redefining underplaying in this movie. Like, I Holy love
cow.
That this,
yes.
this entire performance feels like a dare to like, how little can you
yep.
do to go back to our earlier, note? How flat can your line readings be? How much of a blank slate can your face be?
Yep.
How little can you move your body? And yet he's still compelling. Like, it's one of those
oh my
sort
gosh.
Of,
I know.
Contrary to what you might believe things where it's like the less he's doing, the more we're interested. We're like leaning forward and we want to see what is going on in there. What's happening there? You know, it's, I think in its own way, one of his best performances.
It is. Yeah. I was noticing that, you know, like the scenes where he's over and he's watching Scarlett Johansson's character play the piano and he's just sitting in a chair.
Yeah.
There's a lot of voiceover narration that does
yep.
a lot of the heavy lifting because you need it actually.
Yeah.
Because you have no idea what's going on with this guy, but it's just
yeah.
it's such a like a life force coming at you versus the I mean this guy who you feel like has been sleepwalking through everything.
Yes.
And there was a line in a documentary I watched recently about Clue about Madeline Kahn, Michael McKean, I think it was, who said like she's someone who life goes a couple steps too fast for and she's trying to catch up. And we love that about Madeline Kahn. And
sure.
she knows about that. And so this is a guy who life is going like several steps too fast.
Yes.
For.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is a small performance, but again, it's charming, but it kind of changes on a dime, and yeah, it's
mm-hmm.
interesting. Mm-hmm. Small, very small, but yeah.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and then after this, we have In the Loop, which is a film I loved immediately. I was a fan of The Thick of It, Iannucci. It's so good. I think it's one of my favorite scenes that probably he ever did in his entire career is when he goes in the bedroom and he's using like a children's
yes.
toy to do math about war. It's so good.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Now, this was actually weirdly my my introduction to Iannucci.
Okay.
I hadn't seen The Thick of It, which I think honestly speaks to how well the movie works as a standalone.
Oh, yeah.
Piece. Like if
you
know
need to.
If you know Tucker, if you know this world, obviously you're going to enjoy the movie, but it can be sort of the entry point into not only that character and that world, but really Iannucci's whole worldview and style and so forth.
Yes.
What I think is fascinating here is that, you know, he's playing a military guy.
Yep.
And that sort of or government officials and military guys became this sort of interesting small thread through The Sopranos years and after. One of the ways in which the kinds of roles that he might gravitate towards just to play something 180 from Tony Soprano. Like,
yeah.
And what could be further than this, you know, Jersey accented criminal
yes.
than these sort of button up military or government types. You know, well-educated, they've often got glasses and he's using his real speaking voice.
Yeah.
The Tony Soprano voice, it's always interesting when people find out, was not the way he spoke. That was
no.
an affectation. That
mm-hmm.
was a dialect that he would put on when he was playing mostly sort of criminal characters, but
yep.
that one in particular, like by the time he's playing Tony Soprano, he's done that dialect in a handful of movies before that and would pull it back out when appropriate. But,
mm-hmm.
the way he actually talked is the way he talks in this. That sort of crisp, almost kind of nasal sound.
Yeah.
So he's playing a general here, a high-ranking general, a sort of a Norman Schwarzkopf character who turns out to have the spine of Colin Powell. and this was, from what I understood, a pretty conscious choice that he wanted to do a comedy. It was really important to him to show his comedy chops.
Yep.
And he had done comic stuff before. And The Mexican is basically a comedy, although it has some serious moments. The Sopranos has a lot of funny stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of laughs that are born out of his comic timing and rhythm.
Yeah.
But the underlying subject matter of that show was so dark. And the places it went was so dark that it's, you know, you're hard pressed to find anybody who really actually thinks of it as a comedy.
Yeah.
But he wanted to do some real comedy. And I found an interview even, you know, where he was saying that, you know, when I'm home, when I'm watching new movies, when I go out to the theater, I'm going to see stupid comedies. I'm going to see like The Rocker and The House Bunny and things like that. That gives you an idea of the sort of when this interview is given. But nobody ever offered him that stuff. Nobody thought of him for that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a huge part of that. And I think, I mean, first of all, he just is the comic timing here is ace. You know, it's offhand, but it's sharp. He lands all of his punchlines. He lands his buttons. Like he kills it. But also the thing to remember is that the Iannucci method is that they have a script. They get a nailed scripted take. And then, according to, I interviewed Mimi Kennedy, who most of his scenes are with.
Oh my God. Their rapport is so good.
Fantastic. Take two, he encourages you to go a little off the page and have some fun. And then take three, you can go wherever the scene takes you. And they end up sort of Frankensteining it together from sort of the best from all of those takes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not just that he's able to deliver sharp, funny comic dialogue in a, you know, an appropriate way. It's that he's bouncing off of other actors. He's improvising things. He's going toe to toe, you know, with the actor who plays Tucker. Oh my God. It's right on the tip of my tongue.
Peter Capaldi. Yeah.
Peter Capaldi. Thank you. He's toe to toe with that guy and like doesn't blink, you know,
and that's hard to do with that much coming at you. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. But he, you know, I think it was a really savvy career move in terms of showing not only that he could deliver in a comic performance, but that he could do what was asked of an improvisational comic performance, which keep in mind, this is 2009. This is sort of when the Apatow movie is on the rise. You know what I mean? Like they had put out, you know, Knocked Up and Superbad recently, and such a huge part of the mythos around that factory and all of those actors was that so much of those movies were improvised.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in an interesting way, he was sort of putting himself out and saying, hey, I can do this kind of stuff too. You know, unfortunately he didn't get to work with that group of people, but he did get to do more comedies. When he was on location working on this, he went to the West End production of God of Carnage. And was so crazy about that show and thought it was so funny that he helped get it brought over to Broadway because he wanted to act in it, which he did, and got great reviews as a comic actor and did a few other comic things too. You know, The Incredible Burt Wonderstone is not a great movie, but it's a pretty good one. And he's really funny in it, playing again something that's entirely different from anything else in his repertoire.
Yeah. And one thing I admired when I was reading your book is that for some of these things, he was willing to audition because
Totally.
A lot of actors, once they reach that part where you don't have to audition, they don't want to audition.
And he didn't want to be clear.
No,
he hated auditioning.
But he did.
But he did because, and not even necessarily because he wasn't certain of what he could deliver. He said he wanted to make sure that he'd been in a room with the director, shown them what he had in mind for the characterization, and wanted to make sure that they were on the same page, that he would rather them find that out in advance than, you know, when they're on a set, which is very smart, you know, especially for an actor who was, you know, who worked so hard, who built characters from scratch, and who had really specific ideas about how he wanted to play these things.
Yeah, and the thing I really appreciate with In the Loop is, yes, it shows him as being very funny, but it also shows his verbal dexterity and
Yes.
how well, because a lot of times with Sopranos, he is firing off a lot of dialogue, but not to this extent, not like, back at Tom Hollander or these type of
Right.
actors again and again.
And not
It,
playing an educated character the way that he is here,
yes.
which, like, that's really important. It's very easy to assume that because someone plays, not traditionally book smart characters well, that they must not be book smart themselves.
Yeah.
But like, like when the scene where they're in her office and he's talking about being the Gore Vidal of the Pentagon and all, like,
And that was so funny. Yes.
that's great, but that's exactly what you're talking about. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's, really sharp, intelligent, educated dialogue, and he doesn't flinch at it. He's very comfortable with that stuff.
Yes. No, I love In the Loop. Another performance, of course, that I love that, along with like Enough Said, In the Loop, I kind of jump toward those when I'm recommending other things as well, is Not Fade Away, which is a film I loved immediately when I saw it. I'm sure you did too. Did you see this one in the theater?
I saw it at the New York Film Festival, and the
Oh,
first time
okay.
I saw it, I didn't love it.
Oh, really? Okay.
I thought, I've seen it a couple times since. I hosted a screening of it in LA last month. Obviously, I rewatched it for the book. I have come around to liking it more.
Okay.
But my initial thought was, it felt to me like either the pilot episode of a show
Okay.
that David Chase should do, or like a first season that he had sort of smashed into a 2-hour movie. And on rewatch, I don't disagree with either of those earlier diagnoses, but taking it on its own terms
Yeah.
and with the understanding that, A, number one, this is, the last time they worked together. This is one of a finite number of Jim's performances, and was also apparently the only feature film that we're going to get from David Chase as a director. Like, he did
Okay.
not, from what I understand, he didn't enjoy the experiences of directing. He directed only the first and last episodes of The Sopranos.
Okay.
Was the culmination of like a lifelong dream. He'd always wanted to be a feature filmmaker who had just sort of got stuck in television, but then turned out he didn't actually love the process of being on a set and directing, but wanted to direct this one anyway because it was so personal. Like, you can tell it's an ex like this is him. This is
Oh,
his story
yes.
of growing up in New Jersey. But anyway, taking it sort of on its own terms, I found a lot to appreciate about it. I think there are a lot of tremendous moments in it. I think John McGarroh, who I didn't know at the time and have
Oh, one of
grown
my
to love,
favorites. Yes.
he's
Love him.
wonderful in it.
Yep.
In a great kind of like a young man who is both talented and completely full of shit,
Yep.
doesn't know that he's full of shit, doesn't wink that he's full of shit, but the movie knows he's full of shit. And that's like such a fine line that's so easy to like to fall right off of. And he pulls it off all the way through. I think his performance is really wonderful. But Jim is terrific in this movie.
Yes.
And when I was reading him, because he did do a few promo interviews around the time this one came out about it, was that, Chase was very clearly like writing his dad. Like, he's,
Yep.
everyone in this movie has an avatar in his real life. And that was very much David Chase's old man. And that was how Jim read it when he first read the script and turned it down. Just said, I don't think this is quite right for me. And Chase told a wonderful story about how after he turned it down, he said, okay, we'll work on something else and that's fine. And then he sort of checked back in with Chase about a month later and he was like, no, we still haven't cast it, but I'm thinking about casting, and said someone, he didn't say who, to which Jim responded, oh, you can't cast him. Fine, I'll do it. Like, that was how he sort of shamed him into taking the role. But that what ultimately Jim locked into was he realized how much of his dad was in this character too, which
Yep.
is like unsurprising. They're very similar dudes,
Yes.
men of a certain age of this, of an Italian American background in Jersey in this era. Like, that's, but really sort of found it a kind of a beautiful way to reconnect to his dad, who he had lost a few years earlier, to understand his dad a little better, to kind of key in on the humanity of what life must have been like for his dad when he was growing up. Mm-hmm. And also by that point in his life, having his own fatherhood to pull from. You know, that by this point, the time he's making this movie, Michael's like 10 or 11. And he's been a dad for a while and sort of understands the differences between how his dad raised him and how he was trained to raise his son. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful performance that has one of my, I don't know, three or four favorite Gandolfini acting moments, period, which is his very last shot. The very last scene when his son is driving away,
yes,
driving to California, they're saying goodbye. It's been sort of, you know, strained and difficult, and mom is being insane and so forth. And then the car is starting to pull away and he stops the car. He yells after him, stop, 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 and goes and pretends like he's giving him some sort of winter driving advice and slips a bunch of money into his son's palm and says, you know, if you tell your mom, I'll kill you, and steps away. And Chase loves this actor so much that he holds on him as that car drives away. And his best nonverbal acting, I know we talked about this a little bit earlier, is where he can do this incredible thing where he can give you a character going through three or four different emotions, one on top of the other, you know, consecutively or simultaneously. And you feel all of them and understand the sort of the bleariness between them. He does it in a Sopranos episode called Watching Too Much Television, where he's listening to the Shy Lights singing Oh Girl while he's driving around, and he's singing along, and then he starts to break down because he's thinking about this woman that he loved. Mm-hmm. He does it here in that scene where the sun is driving away and you see all of these emotions, this mixture of sort of sadness, of resignation, of regret for maybe mistakes he might have made, thinking ahead about his own mortality because he does not have long to live. Yeah. Like, all of that's happening. It's 20 seconds of screen time, maybe. But God, he fills it. He fucking fills it. And Chase gives him the space to do that. And it's such a wonderful gesture for a director to give to an actor who he cared about so much. It's really just a tremendous piece of work.
It really is. Yeah. I liked what you were saying too about that this might be like the pilot of a series, because that is my one big note watching it. I found it interesting. I love how it ends with the voiceover. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
with the
God.
Sister. It's an amazing ending. And part of me was thinking, God, she should have been the one that we followed, or the one narrating the entire movie. Mm-hmm. And so part of me was like, you know, he introduces a lot of characters. It's like The Sopranos, almost too many characters. We start to like lose and get confused with some of the peripheral characters. And there are scenes that seem impactful, but I think would have been had we spent more time with them, like the girlfriend's sister and that kind of thing. Like, that's very moving, but it could have had more oomph to it. And I think on the whole, sometimes Chase has trouble with the development of the female characters in places. And so this a little bit I did see with that. But overall, Magaro, I am a huge fan of. He was in a movie last year. It was like me and like five other people loved it. September 5.
Oh, I love September 5.
Oh, good.
Fantastic. Okay. Fantastic movie.
It was on my top 10.
Yeah, it was on my top 10. Okay.
I think it was like number two or three. For me, it was up there.
Yeah. No, it's terrific. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's great in it. Again, just like part of an ensemble. He's not a showy actor. And so I think it's easy to take him for granted. Mm-hmm. The role that he's probably best known for, the main quality of that character is that it's not showy, which is the role in Past Lives. Like he's the third wheel kind of in that movie. And yet you like him, you care about him, you believe him. He's really good.
You don't want to break his heart. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes. No. So I think that this was, and it's, think it was also heartening. I didn't see it in the theater. I think I might have seen it actually after Gandolfini had passed away because
Sure.
this was a busy time in my life as well. So seeing it with
Yeah.
all of those emotions, that scene that you mentioned, of course, hit me, but also the scene, what is it with the dinner table?
Out to dinner with the kid, where he's talking
Yeah,
to him
where he's.
about how he's gonna die, and you're gonna be the man of the family, and so forth. No, this movie came out 6 months before he died. Like
Yeah, and how he
most
had
people saw
fallen
it
in
after he
love
was
with
gone.
someone.
Yeah.
And for like a second, he wants to go. And then he's like, but what would your mother do? Like, what would I? And
Yeah.
it's like everyone knows that from this era of parents and grandparents. And I had parents who stayed together for 30 years that shouldn't have, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And how Magaro's trying to like all of a sudden see him as a human being more than a, which is an important part, especially in your 20s when you're like, oh wait, my
Yeah.
parents are just these flawed people that are just
Yes.
figuring it out like we are. They don't have all the answers. And so I
Absolutely.
do really like that about the performance. And that's interesting that it kind of took, that was almost maybe a little bit of reverse psychology on Chase's part too. Like, oh, I'm going to hire this guy. I mean, that's a good way. Usually an actor, like, oh, we're always rooting for each other. But yeah. So
Yeah.
yeah, he wanted that part. So that's good.
He did. He did. And I'm
Yeah.
glad he got to do it.
Yeah.
And ultimately, from a behind the scenes perspective, one of the things I found out from a few people who worked on that movie was that it was very much it was good that they got to do that last project
Yeah.
together, because they had fences to mend. Things had gotten
Yes.
pretty tense between them by the end of The Sopranos,
Oh my God, yeah.
and they'd had a few years away from each other and really sort of became buddies again through doing
Yeah.
that together. And I'm really happy that they both got that.
Yeah. Well, I know those are the ones that we wanted to go into. You've referenced a bunch of others. Are there any you want to make sure you underline or encourage people to see? I mean, yeah.
One that almost made this list, that came really close, but I tried to keep it to five. There's a film called Down the Shore, which
Okay.
nobody's heard of.
No.
It was made pretty quickly after he finished The Sopranos.
Okay.
It got knocked around from festival to festival, couldn't find a distributor, finally came out just a couple of months before he died, and then kind of disappeared again. But
Okay.
last time I checked, it was pretty regularly on like Tubi and like the Roku, like those sort of like ad-based streamers.
All right.
It's John Magaro, so
Okay.
I got to interview him for the book about both of those movies.
Great.
One of Magaro's first films, and Famke Janssen is the female
Oh, I
lead.
love her. Yeah.
And this was basically, it was very much a labor of love. It's directed by Harold Guskin, who was one of Jim's acting coaches.
Okay.
It was written by Guskin's wife. He and Famke and I think Magaro were all students of Guskin's, so they all did it as a favor for him, because just
Okay.
to like help him get financing and get this movie made. It's a really low-key independent character drama. The closest thing I can compare it to in terms of tone and also some of the narrative is it's sort of a Mystic River sort of thing, but it's one of his very few like straight up no argument about it leading roles. And some of the beats of the script are a little pat, but they're all so genuine, especially him, that it works. It's worth sort of seeking out and sitting through the ill-placed ads every 5 minutes in the middle of scenes, just to get a taste of what that looked like, what he could do with a role with that much meat on the bone.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. I want to thank you so much for doing this, Jason. You're always welcome back. Anyone you
Thank
want to
you.
explore, we kind of have exhausted, as you said, Gandolfini, but do pick it up for Father's Day. But yeah, any topic, filmmaker, actor, you let me know, the door is always open. So thank you
Thank you,
so
dear.
much.
It's always so much fun to come on, and such a pleasure to chat.
Yes, you take care.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the Free Music Archive. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.